This week on Vox Talks, are we about to witness the death of banking? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Let's start with two quotes. Banks today have become vestiges of the traditional financial system and create more burden than value for the system. And things are changing very fast, and banking worldwide will soon die a natural death. Well, these are just two of the more apocalyptic comments in the CEPR's latest Geneva report, which is out this week. It's titled Banking Disrupted: Financial Intermediation in an Era of Transformational Technology. So, will banking as we know it die a natural death, or have we seen this movie before? This week, I spoke to two of the report's authors to find out whether this indeed is the death of banking. Catherine Petralia, who is president and co-founder of Cabbage, that's spelt with a K, and that's a global cash flow fintech and data platform for small businesses. Also to Tara Rice at the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. She's also spent time at the US Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And I started by asking Catherine a question that's probably on quite a few of your minds. Why did she call a startup Cabbage, and why did she spell it with a K?
It's an American term, but it's a euphemism for money from the Depression era. And when we went to get the domain name in 2009 and we didn't have much money, it was cheaper to get Cabbage with a K than Cabbage with a C, but now we have both of them.
Tara, in the report, you found predictions that banks would soon be replaced, but also you found predictions going back more than a century that they were about to be replaced. So should we be taking these reports more seriously in 2019?
The threat of banks' extinction certainly isn't new. I mean, we can even think back to the money market funds in the 1970s. They were threatening the deposit franchise at that time. And in the 1990s, the FDIC chair said at the time that banking is becoming more risky, volatile, and competitive. And then do you remember in the early 2000s, the Walmart bid for a bank? It eventually failed, but only because there was a huge contingency, including Congress, banks, and the public, that blocked the move. We argue, though, in the report that the speed and the scale and the border-hopping nature of big tech and fintech are providing an extraordinary challenge to banks, and that's really what makes the competition different this time.
Catherine, you're a representative of that fintech community. Do you believe the threat to banks is more serious this time?
I do believe it's more powerful, and there are a variety of reasons for that, but a lot of it is simply around access to data and technology and, frankly, customer adoption of internet tools and features and products.
Can you also help to define some of the terms in the report? You list the challenges coming from big tech and fintech firms and challenger banks and neobanks. What's the difference between all of these?
Sure, of course. I think big tech is simply technology businesses and brands that do not have financial services at their core. Examples of those might be Amazon or Facebook or Google or Uber. And fintech firms were established like Cabbage specifically to deliver financial products and services to businesses and consumers. And then challenger and neobanks are a totally different ball of wax. The idea, some of them provide actual checking account and banking services, and some of them emulate that by using prepaid platforms in order to give access to money, mostly for consumers. An example of that would be like PayPal.
We are used to thinking about banks as the Goliaths in this industry, but as the report points out, some of the big tech firms are much bigger than the banks now.
Well, absolutely, especially if you look at companies like Amazon and Google. And not only that, consumers are willing to do business with them for something outside of their core business.
Tara, we're thinking about the threat to banks because we know that there are customers for whom the existing market has not worked. Where do you think the market has failed?
Well, banks haven't necessarily fared so well with the smaller customer. So think about those that maybe want to remit cash back to their country in the form of low-value remittances. This has typically been a very slow, opaque, and costly service. So for example, if you wanted to remit $200 back to your home country, you could end up paying a $14 fee on that. Small business lending is another case, and Catherine can tell you about that. And also in this economic environment, large banks are evaluating what could happen and what happens in a zero rate environment as margins are squeezed, especially in some countries. And so having customers entails fixed costs, and having small value customers still entails those fixed costs. So that's one area where banks definitely could improve. Catherine, do you want to add something on the small business lending?
It's interesting. A lot of people presume that we are taking business away from banks. We provide cash flow services in real time to small businesses. We started out with lending. And everybody said, oh, well, can't these small businesses get a cheaper loan from a bank? But the fact is, if a business is looking for less than $250,000 US dollars, and they're generating less than $500,000 a year in revenue, which is most small businesses in the US and around the world, a bank has a hard time serving them because it's not cost effective for them to deploy $50,000. It costs them as much to make a $50,000 loan as it does a $5 million loan. So these are simply constituents who were previously not served, even though they all have checking accounts at the bank.
Catherine, do you believe this is because banks aren't innovating well enough?
In my opinion, the challenge is that banks are regulated for lots of things. They do lots of activities. And the regulators expect that 15 to 20% of their employees are focused on compliance, both for policy and regulatory issues. And that means that they're kind of hamstrung. They can't move quickly because they are regulated on so many fronts. And this is what gives fintech such an advantage, is their very specific products and services that they're offering. So they're able to face regulation on just the one product they deliver, not on the other 17 that they don't.
Regulation exists for a reason, though, Tara, doesn't it? And as the big tech and the fintech firms expand the range of services that they offer, that they will also find compliance is a challenge to the speed at which they can innovate.
Well, regulating banking is not the same as regulating other types of businesses. So shops can take your money in exchange for product or service, for example. Entrepreneurs can try new risks to innovate and create something new. And if you don't get what you expected, generally you can get a refund, or if necessary, you can rely on consumer protection laws. But a bank is different. We call it special because you're placing your hard-earned money or savings at a bank, and we need different regulations and stricter regulations to ensure that depositors get their money back, and separately also that regulations should mitigate the risk that banks would engage in risky activity that could threaten the depositor's savings. So we say that's what makes banks special. It requires a set of regulations and standards that protect depositors and deter risky behavior at banks. And so most people in public policy would say that's why financial services more generally requires different regulations, and it should be based on the activity. So same activity, same risk. And Catherine will tell you that Cabbage has to comply with a comprehensive set of regulations for the financial products and services that they offer.
Yes, Catherine, tell us, how onerous is regulation for you?
Well, we really got our start understanding that we were going to be offering a product that was regulated. So we've been very compliance minded from the very beginning. I've been in fintech for 20 years, and for the 10 years prior to Cabbage, worked with companies that partnered with banks to deliver financial products and services. We didn't invent that construct, by the way. Capital One was doing that in the 80s, partnering with banks to deliver credit cards to consumers. So this is a well-worn road which we are traveling. And so from our perspective, we view all of the regulations that our partner bank, Celtic Bank, they issue every loan that is made on our platform. We view their regulation as our regulation, but it's one product. It's a small business loan. So we're not regulated for interstate transfer of funds. We're not regulated for all the other activities that banks are engaged with. But as we launch new products and services like payment processing and a charge card product and deposit accounts and checking accounts, we will be partnering with banks for those products too. So we're expanding the regulation to which we're subject as we continue to launch new products.
One of the tasks that banks have always performed is the creation of money. Well, now we have global non-bank currencies, cryptocurrencies. Tara, what do you think are the implications for the stability of the financial system when you have non-bank currencies, particularly Facebook's Libra currency?
So Libra's certainly been in the news, and it's really too early to say what the implications may be for payments and more broadly for the international monetary system, but I'll come back to your question more specifically about currency. However, in this context, and irrespective of the outcome, the Libra proposal has been a wake-up call for authorities. It really demonstrates the transformative potential of the entry of fintech and big tech into the provision of financial services. Authorities will require the arrangement to meet the highest regulatory standards, including for anti-money laundering and illicit financing and all those standards that banks have to comply with when they handle money. And it's highlighted the need for public authorities to collectively set the parameters on which bank and fintech and big tech compete and exchange data and protect consumer interests. And the real public policy challenge that you get at, Tim, is the idea of sort of this currency creation. And actually, the central banks feel that this is something that has been over history very specifically designed to be a sovereignty issue, a monetary sovereignty issue. And so having a large private sector firm create a new kind of currency is really a very difficult public policy question.
Catherine, where do you stand on this? Will it affect your business if there is a large amount of cryptocurrency around, an alternative source of money?
I think eventually it could. The reason we haven't really started working in those types of currencies is largely because it hasn't really received wide adoption from our customer base. There's a lot of currency risk. I've definitely been a bear on cryptocurrency for many years and have often predicted that the price of a Bitcoin would go down. And sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm not. But there is a lot of risk to businesses like ours without the fiat currency that is stable and we can trust. I think that's changing. I do think there's a ton of value with what Tara was saying around remittance and easy access to funds that are in a currency that is more stable in some cases than the sovereign currency in whatever country the recipient may be living.
It has been the case, hasn't it, Catherine, that have been a lot of cryptocurrency enthusiasts on the technology side and traditional bankers and most economists have not really seen the value in cryptocurrencies. Eventually, this disconnect is going to have to break down, isn't it?
Well, you're talking about not just money, but also the fees that banks earn on the movement and holding of money. So it really does create a threat to banks' livelihoods if the holding and movement of money is taken out of their hands. It's not just about the currency creation. It's about all the fees that happen along the way, whether you're talking about core banking, financial transfers, or even payment processing through the credit card association.
Let's look at some of the advantages that the banking sector has. Well, one of them, as you point out in the report, Tara, is that banks have a long history of working symbiotically with governments. In the past, they have funded governments, they financed their wars as well. In return, governments have authorized banks to do business within their countries. Is it going to be hard for new entrants to replicate this sort of relationship? Will this tend to hold back change within the banking sector?
Banks and governments have coexisted throughout much of our modern history, and they've relied on each other to fulfill their missions. So sovereigns have needed banks and the banks their governments. For centuries, governments relied on wealthy merchants and financiers to finance, for example, international trade and war, infrastructure developments, not all good things, right? But banks have developed out of this need, and they have acquired the means to mitigate the governments basically from defaulting on the debt. So they've also developed over the years institutional knowledge and precedent and organization around working with governments. So this is actually one thing I think banks do well. They can really drive policy in ways that make sense to the relationship between banks and governments. Catherine will argue that they don't innovate very well. But I really think that the Libra proposal is really going to put also pressure on banks to step up. They've been relying on status quo and the way they've done things. But if you read some of the quotes from our survey, you'll find that banks have really now focused on what technology can do for their business and what it can do for their customers, how it can lower costs for them, and even improve regulatory compliance. One example is banks are looking to cloud computing and artificial intelligence to help them merge all of the customer data that they have into one data set. Now, this is going to take a while. Catherine will say this may not even be possible. They're such dinosaurs. But I think it is possible. If they can combine all of the information that they have on all the different products and services onto a cloud, into one database, perhaps employ some technology such as DLT, AI, machine learning, well, they would have such an easier time complying with the regulations that have come out of years of operation, but most recently the post-crisis regulatory reforms.
Well, Catherine, do you think that traditional banks are dinosaurs? Can they use their data efficiently as a big tech firm or a fintech can?
Oh, well, of course not. Not today. Tara's right. I think that they could one day if they do that. A lot of banks spend a lot of money paying third parties like Palantir to help them understand their data. The challenge is not that they lack the desire to do it, but many of them have grown through acquisition. And so they have all these disparate systems and hold different data. So you as a bank may not be able to tell your mortgage services business what your auto lending business is doing and how much money that customer receives every month in a deposit account. And the banks have so much data, they should be able to tell us what we need. They should be able to say to me at any point in time, you're spending too much money on interest on this product. You should do this instead. Or you're not earning enough money over here. You should do this instead. They really should be able to do that and be our partners as consumers and businesses.
Why aren't they doing that, Catherine?
They can't. I mean, they can't move fast enough. And the data's everywhere. And you have to think about the core systems on which they're operating. These were all developed in the 70s. They're working on green screens and terminals. And so it's hard for them to perform heart surgery while they're running a marathon. That kind of a system migration is very daunting and has a lot of risk for those banks.
Tara, do you think there has been a change here and that banks are now less focused on using their market power to protect themselves and more focused on innovation?
Banks have been faced with competition for their entire existence. So it's not that this competition is new, but what we're saying is, again, it's different because these big tech companies, such as the Libra program, have the potential to scale so rapidly that they could achieve a global footprint and basically dwarf what the banks are wanting or trying to do. And so they do see this as a threat. It's going to be the catalyst, I think, that really pushes banks to partner more with fintech and to spend more on transformational technology and to try to improve their customer experience.
Catherine, there is an advantage for traditional banks that customers might not be pleased with the service that they get, but they feel comfortable, secure doing business with them. Is this a disadvantage for startups and technology firms? How do you replicate that relationship?
I think the easiest thing is to give the people what they want when they need it and create a better experience. That's really all it takes. When we launched Kabbage in 2010, we were at that time only serving eBay businesses. That's how our business got its start. Today, e-commerce is a small percentage of our business. But we got started asking perfect strangers to come to our website and to give us access to their eBay and PayPal data. They provided credentials, which we didn't receive, but eBay and PayPal did. And everybody said, oh, Kabbage, they are never going to give you that information. It is never going to happen. But it turned out we were providing a service that was so valuable that they couldn't get elsewhere, that they were happy to do it. We almost never get complaints from customers saying, oh, why are you asking me to share this data with you? Whether it's their checking account data or their accounting data, payment processing data, web analytics data, they share it all with us gladly, because it's such a better experience. And I think that is what gives fintechs the advantage, even over these established brands. I mean, most banks have incredibly low net promoter scores. The other brands have incredibly high net promoter scores. And so many people said when Amazon announced they were going to offer a checking account in partnership with Chase, everyone who shops with Amazon's like, sure, I'll open up a checking account. I don't care. How about the Apple Card? I mean, it's receiving wide adoption because the benefits are actually very clear and much better than other card products that are out there, even innovative ones like Capital One.
It does look in 2019 as if we're heading into another business cycle downturn. Now, we remember the last one and the impact that had on the banking sector, but also that some banks were deemed too big to fail. Now, since then, there have been reforms in the banking sector. Tara, do you think these structural reforms will mean that we're in better shape if a downturn does come, and will too big to fail still be important?
I sure hope we don't see one. But yes, the banks today are in such better shape than they were 10, 12 years ago. They have higher capital buffers. They have liquidity buffers. They have resolution plans. There's a resolution regime now in place. In the aftermath of the crisis, we put in a comprehensive set of reforms that covered many things, making banks more resilient, transparency on OTC derivatives, ending or trying to mitigate too big to fail. And many of those reforms are now in place. There is still a little bit more work to do. And I think now, 10 years on, authorities have moved to assessing the impact or the effects of those reforms and fine-tuning those reforms where they need to be fine-tuned. So I think we've really come a long way. the banks are in much better position. Where public authorities have some concerns is what is outside the regulatory perimeter. And this is one of the reasons that Libra is such a concern at this point, because the financial services activities outside the regulatory perimeter are out of the light, like shadow banking, for example. We can't see the buildup of vulnerabilities there. And this is one of the things that set off the crisis. If you can't see the buildup of vulnerabilities, then you can't mitigate those risks and you're really sickly in the dark. So our concerns would be around activities that have migrated outside of the regulatory perimeter that we supervise, oversee, and have good understanding of risk and challenges there.
I know you're not looking forward to it, Tara, but could we conceivably see the same threat to the financial system that we saw 10, 11, 12 years ago?
No, we won't see the same threat. The question is, what threat could we see that we haven't yet identified? Because what happened in 2007, we really didn't see coming. And it was a buildup of vulnerabilities, again, sort of outside a sector that we're comfortable with monitoring. So where the next crisis is going to come from, we don't know. The best thing that we can do collectively as a society is make sure that the institutions that have people's savings, that have their deposits, that these institutions are solid, that they're robust, and that we've got a good system in place in case there are issues within those institutions. But for stuff that is outside the regulated banking sector, risky investments, Bitcoin. As Catherine was saying, Bitcoin could go up or Bitcoin could go down. We call that a risky investment. And if there was to be a downturn and some people lost their investments there, well, they should understand that's a risky investment. So really where our focus is on making sure that the depositors' money is safe, the financial institutions, which are closely connected and, as we said, have a relationship with the government, that they are robust and resistant to any kind of shock.
I would love to give you my crystal ball. I would suggest that we're looking at risks in the corporate debt markets and potentially student loan markets as well. I think the thing that may happen the next time is not one single threat that is posed, but a bunch of smaller ones that happen to create this existential crisis at the same time because of the confluence of events and timing. So I think that there are lots of places where we're not looking, and water always finds a way. Anytime you have bankers who have incentives that are front-loaded and not based on performance, the incentives are misaligned and they're going to find a way.
Catherine, how big a threat would a downturn be to the emergent fintech sector?
Oh, they're vulnerable on multiple fronts. One, because many of them rely on partnerships with banks. And so there's some vulnerability there. And most of them rely on debt markets, at least if they're in any sort of lending or capital intensive business. And so there's always risk there. So the challenge for fintechs is to constantly diversify funding sources and have contingency plans for losing those relationships.
Now, on Vox Talks, we like to make our guests policymaker for a day. And so if there is a policy that you could enact on your day in power that you think would help the banking system, what is it? Catherine, I'll start with you. What would you do?
Absolutely. In many countries, it is possible to get a federal license or a country license in order to engage in the financial activity. In the UK, for example, you can become a licensed lender. And at Cabbage, we did that in 2010. It took like 6 weeks. So that doesn't exist in the US today. And the OCC has talked about this with its fintech charter. The ability to go to a regulator, a national regulator, and say, I'm going to do payment processing. I'm going to do remittance. I'm going to do lending. I'm going to do checking accounts. And to be regulated for that thing, I think actually creates a lot more sustainability and safety for customers, because there's one source of truth and it makes it easier for the fintechs to operate and more efficient. And I think it gives them a better chance of success.
Tara, how about you?
Well, I am a policymaker.
Indeed you are.
Every day. And so I think about these things on a daily basis. And really what I want, if I could have the power, I would want to help authorities find new ways of working together and defining new modes of cross-border and cross-agency coordination. Why do I say this? The Libra example, again, it's just a great wake-up call. It shows us that financial regulation alone cannot solve this problem. Not that Libra is a problem, but we can't solve the issue of like how to regulate a cross-border payment system. We also need data authorities, competition authorities, experts on tax compliance, for example. So this kind of cross-agency, cross-border coordination is going to be more and more and more important as we see more scaling and cross-border technology hopping sorts of businesses. We also think that some rules and standards may need to be revisited to assess whether they remain fit for purpose. And authorities are going to need to determine if there are new categories of entities or activities which may require formal supervisory powers that don't exist now.
What rules do you think might have to be revisited?
A lot of jurisdictions right now are rethinking, coming right back to where we started at the beginning, Tim. They're rethinking how they regulate payments. They're thinking of revising or creating new e-money legislation to deal with these cross-border payments issues that Catherine has raised. Apple Pay, Google Pay may not need to be regulated, but as soon as a company puts some kind of payment system on its own rails, then that's going to need to come into the regulatory perimeter. And how should we think about that? The EU is quite far ahead. They have a e-money directive, but other countries don't.
So let's finish where we started. Catherine, is this the death of banking?
I think it is the death of relationship banking between traditional banks and their customers. I think what is going to happen is fintechs and technology brands are going to step in and unbundle, if you will, many of the products that are offered today by banks and partner with financial institutions to deliver those same products and services in a way that customers want.
And Tara, the last word to you.
I call it creative destruction. I think we'll see a radical transformation. We'll see a radical transformation of banking for the consumer. But in the end, I believe that banking at large is going to remain a business that's conducted primarily by government chartered and regulated entities, including many incumbent banks. But in order to do that, I completely agree with Catherine. There's going to have to be a lot more cooperation and partnership between banks and their fintech peers. Banks would be able to offer free or very cheap and easy transfer money and assets between institutions and individuals. And they could really turn the tide in their favor.
Whatever happens, we can be pretty sure we are going to see some creative destruction. Catherine and Tara, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Tim.
A reminder that the Geneva report is titled Banking Disrupted: Financial Intermediation in an Era of Transformational Technology. It's published in partnership with the International Center for Monetary and Banking Studies, and the authors are Catherine Petralia, Thomas Philippon, Tara Rice, and Nicolas Véron. And it's a free download, of course. Look out for the articles about it and on this topic on VoxEU. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Subscribe to get a new Vox Talk every Friday, and you can look up the archive of Vox Talks on voxeu.org/vox-talks.